Hello and welcome to the History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always I'm joined by my co-presenter John Dorney from the IrishStory.com website. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the programme, please go to the Near podcast page on nearfm.ie/podcast/tag/the-history-show/. This week we're very pleased to be joined by Aidan Beattie. Aidan is a graduate of Trinity College Dublin and is currently studying for his PhD in the University of Chicago. He is researching the links between Zionism and Irish nationalism. You're very welcome to the show, Aidan.
Thanks a lot.
To start off with, I'd just like to ask, what is Zionism?
Well, basically it's one form of Jewish nationalism. In the late 19th century, there would have been maybe at least two movements that would have seen themselves as Jewish nationalist movements. One was what was then called the Bund, and the other one was Zionism. And the Bund was a Yiddish-speaking movement, mainly in Eastern Europe, in Poland, Lithuania, and Russia, which would all have been part of the Russian Empire at that time, which would have put forward the idea that Jews should come together as a nation, but in that part of the world, in the Russian Empire, and would have been quite heavily socialist as well in ideology. Zionism, on the other hand, is also a Jewish nationalist movement, but it says that the solution to the Jewish question or the Jewish problem in the 19th century can only be found by moving all Jews, or as many Jews as possible, from the diaspora to the land of Israel, to Palestine, which at that time was under Ottoman control.
And would there have been a debate in the Jewish diaspora at the time between that idea and the idea of complete assimilation into the respective countries in which they lived?
Yeah, I mean, essentially that's the third way that's put forward to solve this, the problems that Jews face in the 19th century, to do with anti-Semitism or to do with just general forms of economic discrimination. The third one, basically, and it's probably a lot more successful, but we hear about a lot less about it, is that Jews should just move to places like America, assimilate into their culture, and be outwardly American, but at home, in terms of their religious life, they would be Jewish. So they would be American citizens, but Jews.
Hi, Aidan, first of all.
Hello.
So Jewish nationalism, or Zionism, was for a people without a country, without a state. Irish nationalism at the same time is a people living in the one place, in the one country, but without a state. So were there a lot of objective similarities or differences between the two peoples?
I think there are quite a lot of similarities in terms of the fact that both Irish nationalism and Zionism, or just Jewish nationalism, the various types of Jewish nationalism in general, do face a problem of trying to disprove certain stereotypes about themselves, that the reason why they don't have a state is because they're not capable of ruling themselves. And you can see this in both movements, of the constant desire to prove that actually we are capable of ruling ourselves, and we are capable of being a European nation like any other. So, for instance, we have this idea in Irish nationalism of Sinn Féin, or of an Irish Ireland, that we can turn to our own traditions and our own roots and be a nation sort of standing on its own two feet. And there are very similar things in Zionism. There's one of the first essays that puts forward the idea of Zionism is called Auto-Emancipation, with the idea being exactly that, the Jews should free themselves. They shouldn't rely on others, but they should rely on themselves, which means that they need to develop the very capability to be a free nation.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent is this kind of a reaction to the idea that the Irish are inferior? We know from cartoons of the late 19th century that the Irishman is an ape, he's a terrorist, mm-hmm. and so forth. And there's not quite the same, maybe, with similar stereotypes against Jewish people.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a huge part of it. And that's, there's a kind of a tension between two things in both Zionism and Irish nationalism, that on the one hand, there is this internal issue of trying to react against certain stereotypes, certain allegations that you're not a real European people, that you're an inferior people. And at the same time, it's just a general part of European nationalism to constantly engage in a certain kind of social reform, or to look inwards and say, well, what do we need to do better as a society? And those two things are always kind of in tension when you're trying to explain why Zionism espouses certain things, or why Irish nationalism has this anxiety about proving that we are a real people, mm-hmm. that we are a true nation, that the two things are interacting.
Mm-hmm. And one thing, of course, as a nationalist, you can do is found your own state. But what else can you do, or what did nationalists hope they could achieve in proving themselves as good as anyone else?
Well, first of all, both Zionism and Irish nationalism do develop a big obsession with agrarianism and with the land and with agricultural labor. And to a certain degree, I think they're both feeding off these stereotypes. There are huge amounts of stereotypes in the 19th century that Jews are a kind of lazy people, that they're not capable of productive labor. And it draws on stereotypes about Jews as kind of natural capitalists, or that they're all money lenders, and that Zionism in many ways accepts these stereotypes and says, well, we need to reform ourselves as a nation. And there are similar stereotypes then about that Irish people are just inherently lazy, and that they don't know how to do a good day's work for a fair day's pay and stuff like that, which draws on to a certain degree on the history of the famine and things like that, that the Irish are clearly not capable of running their own country. And the same kind of agrarian ideology that pops up in Irish nationalism, I think, is drawing on similar things with organisations like the Irish Agricultural Organisation Society and the cooperative movement do really stress this this need to engage in a kind of social reform and to make the Irish a nation of hardworking agrarian labourers.
Mm-hmm. What role does language play?
Well, both have, as is well known, a real obsession with returning to a kind of ancient language, and that the revival of Hebrew or the revival of Irish, I think for both movements, were not just about the language themselves, but about what the language symbolised. That there is this image of a kind of biblical classic age of Judaism, and that by learning Hebrew and reviving Hebrew as a spoken language, the Jews who moved to the land of Israel will be also returning to this kind of society, a kind of proud, glorious society. And you can see similar things with the revival of Irish, that organisations like the Gaelic League from 1893 onwards are really saying that if you learn Irish, you're going back to a kind of an Ireland of Cúchulainn and of Fionn McCool. And also that the last remnants of Irish-speaking communities along the Western Seaboard are the ones who have escaped British rule the most, either for geographical reasons or for political reasons, that the British state just isn't as strong there and they're furthest away from Britain, so that they've sort of retained this ancient Irish essence within them, and that by learning Irish, you too can gain access to that kind of pure, glorious Irishness.
Now, Aidan, if we could just look at one fascinating character in Irish history who's sadly very overlooked, Michael Davitt. What was his connection to the Jewish community?
Well, Davitt is usually known for his involvement in the land war in the late 1870s and early 1880s, which means that there's about 25 years of his life there. He died in 1906. That just gets forgotten quite a bit. After the land war, he actually travelled. He had contracted cholera, and as part of his recuperation, he went travelling through Italy, Egypt and Palestine, and on a religious pilgrimage, and had seen the Jewish community there, and had become also in these years, in the 1880s and 1890s, became a very well-known international advocate of kind of progressive causes. And in 1903, there was a pogrom in Chisinev, in what's now Moldova. Again, it was then part of the Russian Empire. And this became a huge international event that seemed to confirm for a lot of people that not only that the Jews faced a very precarious existence in the Russian Empire, but also that the Russians are just a kind of barbaric people who can't be trusted around ethnic minorities and so on. And so Davitt was invited as a kind of international advocate for these kinds of causes. He was invited to go to visit Chisinev as a journalist for the New York American, which was owned by William Randolph Hearst, and wrote a series of articles for the New York American about what he saw there, which were then later collected into a book and published by the Jewish Publication Society in Philadelphia. And in this, he not only talks about the very violent situation that Jews face in the Russian Empire, but also says that the only solution to this, he now believes, is Zionism. Now, you can read into this in a couple of different ways. One is that he really projected Irish nationalism onto Zionism. So he talks about how the police in Russia are just like the RIC, and he uses the word, he describes the anti-Semitic legislation as penal laws, which obviously has a very loaded meaning in an Irish context. He also very oddly says that he's not necessarily opposed to anti-Semitism, and says that where anti-Semitism is a form of anti-capitalism, he's quite in support of this. And in some of his other books, like his, he had written a book maybe 2 years before this called The Boer Fight for Freedom. And like a lot of people who were opposed to the Boer War within Britain or Ireland, he took a very anti-Semitic position on this, that it was sort of Jewish financiers pushing Britain towards war. So there's a very odd view of Jews as being both a kind of proxy for Ireland or for Irish nationalism, and then also a certain amount of anti-Semitism that also lends itself to a certain amount of pro-Zionism, that he does agree that the Jews are a kind of people who have a natural capacity for capitalism and for money-making, but that this is a result of the persecution they've suffered within the Russian Empire, that they've been forced into certain occupations and they've had no choice but to excel at those jobs.
Aidan, the First World War was a landmark event for both Irish nationalism and for Zionism. In Ireland, famously, we had the rise of Sinn Féin and all that followed from that. But also in the First World War, the British took Palestine from the Ottoman Turks,
mm-hmm.
and promised it to the Jews. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, first of all, they promised Palestine to the Jews. They possibly also promised it to the Arabs. There is this thing called the Balfour Declaration in November 1917, where Britain says that it looks with favour upon the establishment of a Jewish state. Or it doesn't actually say state, it says a Jewish homeland. And it's a very carefully worded document. And if you go to the British National Archives, you can see all the original drafts where the word state is slowly taken out, and it's intentionally set up as a kind of a vague document where Britain seems to be offering a lot, but also says basically if any of this violates the rights of what it calls the non-Jewish inhabitants, we have the right to back out. So it seems to offer Palestine to the Jews and seems not to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 2 years prior to that, a thing starts called the Hussein McMahon correspondence. It's, if you've ever seen Lawrence of Arabia, it's a big part of the plot of that film, that the British consulate in Cairo is exchanging messages with the people who are the Sharif of Mecca, the guardians of Mecca, where they are offering them all of the Middle East, provided they rise up against the Turks. Now, again, they issue these very well-worded, well-phrased promises that seem to offer all of the Middle East, but perhaps only offer what today is Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia and Jordan. So it seems to leave in Palestine, seems to leave out Palestine.
Mm-hmm. So you've two competing groups who both think that the British have promised them this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's obviously going to become very quickly a very big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, by 1920, there's violence in Palestine of Arabs rising up against British rule and saying, we want to be part of the Syrian state that is possibly about to be established, that itself also is transferred then from the British to the French. There's then a third set of agreements that the British are entering into, where they're offering Lebanon and Syria to the French, and possibly also offering Turkey and Constantinople to the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Russians don't get any of that because of the Bolshevik Revolution. They stop being allies of Britain. So basically you have Britain making promises, and quite contradictory promises, to three groups of people. And that obviously becomes a defining feature of the politics of the Middle East after World War One, that all of these promises now have to be realized in some way.
Now, after the First World War, or before, I think, but more so after the First World War, Zionist colonists began to arrive in mm-hmm. Palestine. And at the same time, obviously, in Ireland, you've got guerrilla warfare and you've got the Irish War of Independence, the revolution in Ireland. It seems to me, from my 21st century perspective, as if Irish nationalists would have more in common with the people whose land was being taken away by incomers
mm-hmm.
than the people who were taking it. But that there were links between Irish nationalists and Zionists at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to a certain degree, you would imagine that they would have had an antipathy towards Zionism. But at the same time, of course, the Zionists are attacking the British, and there's a sense of a kind of shared enemy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when the Zionists are realizing, or at least the more radical Zionists are realizing, that they will now have to attack the British, and they do start to look at, well, what countries have gone to war with Britain in the past that have faced similar situations to us? And so people like Zev Jabotinsky or Yitzhak Shamir, who are very much on the sort of radical right wing of Zionism, do really look to Irish nationalism as a kind of an example to learn from. Much more so Shamir, who's sort of a younger generation of people who are much more radical in their politics. During World War II, they feel that they should not make any common cause with Britain and completely attack Britain and use World War II as a kind of opportunity in the midst of Britain's crisis to gain Jewish independence in Palestine. And in that, they see a very clear parallel with World War I, where they feel that this is exactly the same as what the Irish were doing then, of using World War I as a crisis from which they can gain independence. A man called Avraham Stern, who's one of the leaders of this radical right wing, translates P.S. O'Hegarty's The Victory of Sinn Féin into Hebrew. And Yitzhak Shamir, who would later on be the Prime Minister of Israel in the 80s, when he's sort of on the run in Palestine, adopts the codename Michael from Michael Collins, as a kind of homage to Michael Collins. And there's similar things, actually, that they feel there's similar things going on with a man called Lord Mourne, who's one of the leading British diplomats in Cairo. He's a member of the Guinness family, and they gun him down in Cairo, which quite offends Winston Churchill, who is a close personal friend of his.
Now, as you were saying earlier, Aidan, about the problems that the Jewish community faced in the Russian Empire, in the late 19th and early 20th century, we see a lot of immigration from those regions into Ireland, from Lithuania and Latvia and Western Russia. And I suppose one of the products of that immigration is Robert Briscoe. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us who he was and what connection he had to both Irish nationalism and Zionism?
Well, Briscoe, during the War of Independence, is a sort of lieutenant of De Valera's. And so during the Civil War, then, he sides with De Valera, with the kind of moderate anti-treaty side. And after 1926, joins De Valera in Fianna Fáil. Now, as I say, people like Brian Hanley have been bringing to light recently, the split between Fianna Fáil and the IRA is not as clean as it was once thought to be. And Briscoe does maintain certain contacts, maybe even just at the level of remaining quite good friends with people that are in the IRA, whilst he's also a Fianna Fáil backbencher. And like a lot of Irish Jews, he becomes very interested in Zionism, and has a fairly close relationship with a man called Zev Jabotinsky, or Vladimir Jabotinsky, who's a quite leading Zionist, a leading right-wing Zionist, and claims in his autobiography that he was setting up sort of Zionist IRA training camps in Ireland. Now, the training camps might have just been Jabotinsky and a few other Jewish visitors to Ireland having a chat with Briscoe and some of his friends in the IRA. It mightn't have been a full-on training camp. But he also then sets up links between Jabotinsky and De Valera. One of the other reasons why a lot of Zionists become very interested in Ireland is because after 1937, the British start talking about partitioning the country, which obviously a lot of Zionists don't want to happen. They want to have as much of Palestine as possible for a Jewish state. So they again start looking at previous examples of partition, and they look at Ireland as a place where partition has happened, and they want to learn from that. So Jabotinsky, as well as a number of other Zionists, make contact with De Valera. And Jabotinsky does it through Briscoe and actually meets De Valera in 1938 on a visit here, and seems to have really taken quite kindly to De Valera, seems to have felt that De Valera was a sort of pro-Zionist in a sense. And De Valera himself then, after 1948, when he is out of power, he makes a kind of semi-official visit to Israel with Briscoe, where they are able to meet with David Ben-Gurion, who's now the Prime Minister of Israel, in a meeting that was probably set up by Yitzhak Herzog, who had been the first Chief Rabbi of Ireland and later on became the Chief Rabbi of Israel, and whose son, or one of his sons, was a President of Israel in the 80s. His other son, Nathan Herzog, was a quite leading operative for Mossad, who was quite important in setting up kind of secret discussions between the Jordanian government and the Israeli government in the 80s. So they're quite an important family in Israeli politics, who themselves have this Irish link that De Valera and Briscoe use to just have kind of informal chats with the Israeli government in the 50s.
So what did De Valera think about the situation in Palestine? Was he well informed about it?
He doesn't seem to have been too well informed. There's a man called Judah Leb Magnus, who's the head of the Hebrew University, who writes to De Valera in 37. He's one of these people who wants to know, basically, how do we stop partition? Can you help us? Can you give us some advice? And De Valera himself admits in his response to Magnus that, well, I don't know the situation as well as you do, but you're definitely right, the partition is a terrible thing. And he can tell, he knows that much at least, that partition is something that to always be avoided. And I think, like a lot of other Irish nationalists, he may, or at least the more conservative Catholic end of Irish nationalism, he has views of Jews that are maybe informed by either a kind of sympathy for Jews suffering persecution, as well as maybe a certain amount of anti-Semitism or stereotypical views about Jews.
Yeah, now, while there wasn't organised anti-Semitism in Ireland, there are occasional kind of glimpses of Irish nationalist anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that?
You'll find, I mean, it's one of those things that just pops up in very odd places where you don't really expect to see it. You'll find, for instance, ads in An Clive Sulish from the early 1900s saying, a particular clothing company might say, well, you should buy clothes from our company because we're a fully Irish Ireland, Irish-owned, Irish-made company. Don't buy from Jews. Or you'll see anti-Semitic cartoons in the Gartha magazine in the 1920s, which you wouldn't really expect.
The Gardaí are being anti-Semitic. Can you explain that?
I think part of it is that Ona Duffy is a fairly conservative and fairly right-wing figure who doesn't like Jews.
O'Duffy, the leader of the semi-fascist blue shirt movement.
Well, O'Duffy is also the editor of the Garda magazine, the Garda Review, and his personal views do pop up a lot in this magazine. It's basically just his flagship journal to express his views. I think there's also a deeper issue that maybe you could read into, that Irish, if you view Irish nationalism as a kind of return to a European identity or an attempt to prove that we're a true European people, then to a certain degree you would expect anti-Semitism, because Jews are always the people against which Europeans define themselves. And you could read into maybe the kind of body politics of these cartoons that appear in the Garda magazine, where the Gardaí are always portrayed as these very strong, tall, virile men, and they're clearly being contrasted with these very weak, slovenly, dirty Jews. And clearly there's a lesson that the people like O'Duffy are trying to put forward here of, this is the ideal new Irish man who is strong and clean and hygienic, and this is something you shouldn't be, and this is something against which we're defining this new identity. Mm-hmm. And I think there's similar things you could read into about anti-Semitism in general in Ireland in the early 20th century, particularly when it pops up in these very overtly nationalist categories, or in these very overtly nationalist publications. Maybe then also there's just the influence of Catholicism here, that a lot of people have views of Jews that are informed by biblical sources rather than contemporary sources, and so they view Jews in terms of deicide or as mm-hmm. kind of the traditional enemies of Christianity.
Well, at Mass, I think, if I'm not mistaken, you had, until quite recently, you were supposed to pray for the conversion of Jews.
At certain times of year, yeah, I think that's one of those things that's been removed after Vatican II. Yeah,
so
removed
after Vatican. Believe it, it kind of seeps into people's consciousness. I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. There's just a kind of a casual background noise of anti-Semitism that you'll find mm-hmm. a lot in
European Catholic culture, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, we've talked about the role or the similarities, the parallels between Zionism and Irish nationalism when they're both trying to form a state. They both do get their state, or part of the state that they want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How well do they achieve their goals in terms of what they envision for the nation and how they achieve it?
Well, in the terms of Zionism, they do get a state, but they get a state made up of sort of the people that they never really expected to end up with a state. There are, maybe 6 million Jews wiped out during the Holocaust, and they're the natural demographic of Zionism as far as the Zionists are concerned. So they lose the people that they thought would make up the state, who would be these fairly well-educated, fairly Europeanized Jews. The Jews who do come and join the Jewish state, particularly in the 1950s, are predominantly from the Middle East, mm-hmm. What are usually called Mizrahi Jews. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of coercion of them to force them to fit into this essentially European culture and European society that has already emerged in Palestine prior to the establishment of the state in 1948. And there are certain problems that then start to emerge to do with language, particularly. This revival of Hebrew had always been something that had been seen as integral to the project of making a Jewish state. Most of these people who come in are predominantly Arabic speaking, and a huge amount of coercion has to happen to force them to learn Hebrew, to force them to assimilate into a Hebrew speaking European culture. But ultimately they are quite successful in this. They do create a Hebrew speaking society with people basically living their lives exclusively or almost exclusively through Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And there are similar things that had happened prior to the founding of the state, where Yiddish and languages like this had to be basically erased and coerced out of people. Mm-hmm. And that's probably, I think, the most obvious differences between Irish nationalism and Zionism, that Irish nationalism in the pre-state period does talk a lot about reviving Irish, or Pádraig Pearse had talked about that there would be a population of 20 million in the island, mm-hmm. soon after independence and things like this. And there are these very idealized images of what Ireland would be like once independence was achieved, and it's quite debatable whether any of those were really realized. Certainly the history of the Irish language revival after independence stands in real stark contrast to the history of the revival of Hebrew, that the language continues to really decline or at least stagnate. There's no real successful project of reviving Irish as a vernacular language for the majority of the nation.
We're just going to take a very quick break, and we'll be back with Aidan Beattie shortly. And we're back with Aidan Beattie discussing the links between Zionism and Irish nationalism. Now, Aidan, in the recent article that you wrote for the Irish Story website, I thought one of the things that was really quite interesting was this idea of former black and tans who have now moved into the Palestinian police and are facing very similar circumstances from people who, in many cases, are inspired by what has happened in Ireland during the War mm-hmm. of Independence.
Well, it happens that by the time the War of Independence has come to an end in Ireland, British rule in Palestine has been kind of officially legitimated, that the League of Nations has been established and has granted a mandate to Britain to rule Palestine. Now, if you're a bit unsympathetic, you might say it's really just a new form of colonialism, that there's a kind of a legal veneer, and then beneath this, Britain is still just ruling as a colonial power in Palestine. And it has similar mandates for Iraq, and the French government have ones for Syria and Lebanon. So by the mid-20s, the British are sort of setting up a colonial regime, or a kind of something like a colonial regime in Palestine. And so they're looking for someone to run the police service in Palestine. So they ask General Sir Hugh Tudor, who had been the head of the Black and Tans in Ireland.
Tudor's Tufts.
Yes, so indeed. And a lot of Black and Tans do come with him and quickly take over the running of the police force in Palestine, which is an armed police force as well, not a civilian police force. Mm. And then a man called Tom Segev, who's an Israeli historian, in his history of this British mandate period in Palestine, he does call this Sinn Féin in Ireland, that a lot of these former Black and Tans themselves feel that there's something very similar going on here, particularly from 1936 to 1939, when there's what's usually called the Arab Revolt. Mm. After the rise of Hitler, there's a much greater level of Jewish migration, really just Jews fleeing Nazi Germany, and a lot of them come to Palestine. And as you have this increase in the Jewish population, it creates an even greater fear on the part of Arabs that they're about to lose their country. And so this leads to what's called the Arab Revolt in 1936. It goes on until 1939, and is really only ended when the British make a promise to stop Jewish migration into Palestine. And a lot of the Black and Tans who are now in the Palestine police do feel that there's something similar going on here. There was a quite interesting oral history project a few years ago run through the Centre for Middle Eastern Studies in Oxford, where former members of the Palestine Police were interviewed. And a lot of the ones who had been former Black and Tans do bring this up, that this was a kind of a sense of deja vu for them.
Oh, just to be clear, were they fighting the Jews or the Arabs or both?
They would have been, between 36 and 39, they would have been fighting the Arabs. Then in 39, the British issue a white paper where they say, OK, we agree now to stop Jewish emigration. Now, from an Arab point of view, this is exactly what they wanted. They can now go back to concentrating on the project of removing the British and becoming an independent Arab state. From a Zionist perspective, it's the worst possible thing, because now not only is there Hitler in power in Germany, but Hitler is actually now expanding his power. And this is the one time that they really would have wanted a kind of Jewish refuge. Mm. But the gates are closed. And it's at that point then that you get the more radical right-wing Zionists attacking the British. The sort of left wing of Zionism is much stronger at this point and is really the dominant force within Zionism, and they feel they've no option but to side with the British. But the more radical elements feel that Britain is just fair game, and that the number one objective should be to kick the British out of Palestine. Mm-hmm. And it's at that point then that much more open conflict starts between Zionists and the British, and people like Avraham Stern forms an organization called Lehi. It's usually just called the Stern Gang. That's quite a small group of maybe 500 people. There's a slightly bigger group then of about 3,000 called Etzel, the National Military Organization. And that's the organization that possibly Bob Briscoe, his father, was running supposed IRA training camps with Jabotinsky. And this group, the National Military Organization.
And famously, the Stern Gang, I think, blew up the King David Hotel and killed many members of the British administration.
Yeah, I think that was, I might be wrong, but I think that was Irgun. That was Irgun, okay. The National Military Organization. They actually killed quite a few Jews as well. Okay. There's about 90 people or 80 people that are killed. And they're a mixture of British, Arab and Jewish.
And ironically, or maybe not, I'm told by people who know about these things that the IRA of the time, of the early 50s, rather admired this particular operation.
Yeah, there's it's sort of always hard to pin these things down historically, because the kinds of people that are involved in this are not the kind of people that leave behind too much in the way of documents. But there's often rumours you'll come across of Irish-Americans who were supporters of the IRA were also sending money to these kind of groups, and there's just a general shared anti-British feeling that both groups had, that I think feeds into a certain level of respect that they both have for each other. It's not always clear how much it is that more, is it ever anything more than that? Are there physical links between these groups, or are they actually talking to each other, or just talking about each other?
And that brings me to our final question, which is that Irish Republicans and Zionists felt a certain amount of affinity for each other's methods, for each other's goals. But if you go up to Belfast today, you'll see murals celebrating the PLO, possibly not Hamas, but certainly Palestinian resistance. So Irish Republicans have definitely fallen out of love with Zionism in the last, say, 40 years. How has that happened?
I think there's a general story here that just the European left in general has moved a lot away from Zionism, and Zionism itself has moved a lot away from left-wing politics. We tend to forget this today, but the first leadership within Israel after 48, people like David Ben-Gurion, and then to the left of him, a party called Mapam, would have been quite left-wing in their politics, and would have been seen quite favourably by people like Bertrand Russell or Jean-Paul Sartre. Various figures within the European left had a lot of affinity for Zionism in the 50s and into the early 60s. But I think with the Six-Day War, as Israel changes from just being a kind of pioneer society to being a kind of settler society.
Mm-hmm. This is when, in 67, when Israel takes the West Bank and occupies where the Palestinians had been living.
Yeah, it becomes a country that's now ruling a large Arab population and not granting them, say, voting rights, and then, say, after the mid-80s, it starts to suppress, sometimes quite violently, Palestinian nationalism. And there's a general story there of just Europe falls out of love with Zionism, essentially. I think there's also a story that runs parallel to that in the Irish case, that Irish republicanism, maybe after the the border bombing campaign of the 1950s, starts to engage in a certain amount of soul searching, and out of that starts to embrace a lot more left-wing ideology. So that you get the rise of the Workers' Party and groups like that, or what will eventually become the Workers' Party. So it's not just that the European left is falling out of love with Zionism, it's also that Irish republicanism is becoming a lot more left-wing and therefore is becoming a lot more pro-Palestinian.
But I think, as you've mentioned before in some of the articles you've written, that in areas where Irish republicanism was more to the right, such as the diaspora in New York and Boston, mm-hmm. that affection for Israel and Zionism persisted a lot longer than it did in Ireland.
Yeah, again, there's sort of little pieces of anecdotal evidence to do with this, which is probably much more to do with American politics and Irish politics, that being pro-Israeli is a much more common thing in America than it is in Europe, and not sort of, you know, the friends of Irish republicanism in America are much more likely to have somewhat American-type views about these things. And then it's debatable how much do they actually know about what Irish nationalists in Ireland think of Zionism or of Palestinian nationalism, or even of socialism. I mean, how much do they know that these organisations they're supporting are actually espousing a lot of anti-colonialism and a lot of socialism?
I suppose that leads on to connections between, as you're saying there, the IRA and groups like the PLO, in terms of training and finance in the 80s and the 90s, and also groups like Gaddafi's Libya, mm-hmm. that would have been very anti-Zionist and pro-Palestinian in the 80s.
Yeah, it does. This sort of general change in Irish nationalism, as well as these growing sympathies for the Palestinians, does feed into a lot of this. And again, you know, there are certain, let's say, people like Brian Hanley in his History of the Workers' Party does talk a lot about this, about you can find hints where you can tell that there are certain links going on between the Provisional IRA and various Palestinian groups where they're training with each other and so on. There's probably also just there's something maybe a bit more pragmatic to this, that they're just buying weapons from them, and this is not just about a shared ideology, it's also about the business of international arms trade.
Well, unfortunately, we have to finish up the discussion there, Aidan. Thank you very much. That was Aidan Beattie from the University of Chicago. And also thanks to John Dorney, my co-presenter. My name is Cathal Brennan, and thanks again for listening to The History Show on Near FM.